my neighbor watering. And you know that when you hold a hose of water, that the hose gives a shape to the flow of the water. And all of you know that if you hold your thumb at the end of the hose, you can further shape the flow of the water. And you can get a variety, you get a spray, you can get more of a direction. But it's quite apparent in common sense that you can shape flows. Now, consciousness is indeed a flow. Consciousness can be shaped. But in saying that, there is an inherent paradox. It's the same paradox that exists in respect to light. Is light a wave or a particle? The same paradox occurs when one asks, is consciousness a field or a flow? Because while we can make very accurate statements about consciousness being a flow and therefore capable of being shaped, we can, on the other hand, make an equal number of observations and statements and accrue evidences that consciousness is a field and not a flow at all. And if it were a field, it can be generated, but the generation resists shaping, or the shaping would be an epiphenomenon. Is consciousness a field or is it a flow? And the resolution is again similar to that which nuclear physics has come to understand about life. It is both. And it is both in such a comprehensive way that in order for us to master the faculty of consciousness, we need to train ourselves in both approaches at the same time. Now, most education is just sand play. Consult your own experience. Can you remember what you learned in the fifth grade? How about the eighth grade? Your second year of university? How much do you remember? You see, it's sand play. The infamous retention curve plummets. Goes very close to zero after about 10 years. This education is different. It is structurally different. It's not fool's gold, it's real gold. It holds up under the assay test of your reality. But this program both works to shape the flow of consciousness and to generate the patterned field of consciousness at the same time. In the first year, we concentrate on generating the field of consciousness. In the second year, we concentrate on shaping the flow of consciousness. Two distinguishable but not distinct characteristic strategies towards the same wholeness. Now, in generating a field, your main concern, when it's the field of consciousness, the field of experience, is to generate richness. You want to add as much as you can that will contribute to the richness of the stew, of the mixture, of the complexity of the possibilities. And in fact, there is a correspondence between the richness of generated experience and the power of the integral experience. For someone who doesn't have a very rich experience, even if they came to a moment of Satori, it wouldn't occur to them as being very much at all. The generation of richness of consciousness is complemented in the second year, where the concern is to make the various shapes of the flow of consciousness available to you. In other words, there's not just one shape which is optimal, but there are a whole variety of shapes. But the variety of the shapes fall under a general kind of a classification, a quaternary. Just like in the first year, the generation of the richness of experience is also capable of being designated as a quaternary. Now you can, if you wish, if one wished to be extremely technical, the quaternary is actually a 16-fold section. If one wished to really be yogic about it, be like an old 3rd century yogacara and look accurately, is that structure 4? No. Each of the 4 is a 4. It's 4 square. That's 16. And one could go even further, push the Abhidhamma to its limits and see that only half of the 16 can be distinguished in any kind of a stage or phase separation, and that fully 8 of them only occur as a trill together. And one could then say that really, you're not dealing with 2 quaternaries, but you're dealing with 2 16s in a way. But the whole program would be a 32-part section. If you worked on that level of resolution, it would take an entire lifetime. It would take 30 to 40 years to be able to adequately acquaint yourself with each of the 32 sections and to make sure that you could, in a spontaneous way, relate to any of the 32 in any kinds of combinations or leading up to a whole. The discipline required is enormous. So instead of going for a 40-year program, in searching to try and find some more reasonable, humane way to get most of it, instead of going for the 100% that a 32-part form would deliver, how about the 90% that an 8-part form would deliver? 90% is good enough. All of us have enough pizzazz at this stage of evolution that given 90%, you can intuit and fill in by your confidence that extending this 90% will yield you a picture of the whole form. That last 10% in Christian tradition is called faith. You have faith that continuing in this way, it would extend. In our educational form, the generating of the pattern in the first year, the development of that pattern, is all concerned with the richness of experience. And part of the richness is the actual accumulative power, so that we stagger our quaternary using nature as a foundation and setting in that the ritual circle, so that the natural foundation is brought together in a stable base, the ritual circle of comportment. And then, as if to emphasize that, we put a mythic structure, which is also circular, inside of that ritual circle, so that it is braced, so that by the time of the first three quarters of the first year, we have a foundation that can support a finding of the center. An analogous procedure would be the way a clay pot is thrown. You can do it by rolling your clay into little sausages of clay and putting them on top of each other. This is a static way. And you can make a pot this way. And actually, you can get fairly far with this technique. But coiled, static clay pots don't fire so well. They don't really hold up to the wear and tear of existence so well. Whereas the dynamic process of a thrown pot takes the firing in its shapedness and sustains itself through a lifetime of extraordinary life. Thrown pots leave shards that last for thousands of years. But in making dynamically a clay pot, you can't use the same techniques and the same awareness that you do with a static process. A dynamic process is different. It is a transformation of every element. The hands in making the static pot work in kind of a mechanical way, rolling the clay. You can see first graders or prisoners, new prisoners, making their little clay pots. But when you throw a pot dynamically, you first of all have to have the spinning wheel, and then the clay is thrown on the pot, and the whole process of beginning is actually learning to educate, to sensitize your hands to be able to find the center. In a dynamic process, you must find the center. In a static process, you just build up around the edges. You measure out what you want and then just build it up, post and beam, post and beam, post and beam. In architecture, it's the old post and beam. And that's a static structure. It doesn't take any kind of stress or energy very well. It breaks. And personalities made on that kind of a basis break. And they break all the time, they fracture, and they require bandages and splints, and after 40 or 50 years, one begins to look like the knobbed and gnarly old oaks. But there is a different way. There's a dynamic way. It's like the thrown pot. And in finding your way to the center, you begin somewhere in your material. It doesn't matter exactly where. But you begin with a tracer line. And the tracer line, by watching the configuration of the tracer line, will show you where the center is. And you introduce the tracer line. As the clay mass spins around, the spinning, the dynamic itself discloses where the center is with the tracer. And that's where the two thumbs go in together. And that's where the feel of the hands together shape the pot in the dynamic way. Pull it, as it were, from the center. One pulls the material from the immaterial center and shapes that pot, in a dynamically shaped pot that way, fired holes, services. A structure built not on post and beam, but on a rooted and cantilevered structure will hold its strength for centuries, if not millennia. Using the right materials, using whiskered ceramic materials, one could probably build structures that would last as long as mountains would last. You could build buildings that would last for geological eons. You could build transportation vehicles that would last similarly long. You can build personalities that will service you as long as you wish to use them. Almost of an indefinite. The myth of that is immortality. Now, in our program now, what we're trying to do in the mid part of the last of the eighth section is to disclose how the reflective intelligence of the 20th century has, in a very rapid way, become aware. When I say rapid, I mean like that. So I'm going to give you an example of just how fast the change was in the first third of the 20th century by using just one example so that you can appreciate the incredible transformation, that when a transformation happened, what obtained before looks more and more like a static form of what now, after the transformation, is a dynamic form. And you're given to understand that each transformation effects this kind of differentiation. What seemed to be dynamical before, transformed again, becomes hyper-dynamical, leaving the old dynamic to looking like it was indeed just another version of stasis. It brings to mind Salvador Dali's great painting, The Maximum Speed of Raphael's Madonna, where all the little particles of Raphael's painting are put into a slight blur by Dali, and you see the maximum speed of Raphael's Madonna. And it's very close to the kinds of paintings that one would have seen in the middle of the Gobi Desert in the 4th century, where the atomic structure of things was seen spiritually. The caves of Dunhuang and places like that. We can see some slides. Next week I'm going to show you what we're going to talk about this week in visual terms. In our text, then, one of our texts, The Particle Explosion, if you have a copy, you can note down for yourself that we're going to use pages 72 and 73, and then skipping over to page 85, 72, 73, and 85. On 72, the section begins, the first new particles. What new particles? In 1923, that's 66 years ago, that's just 66 years. That's one lifetime. In 1923, a young physicist, a Russian, named Dmitry still Belzer, began to investigate gamma rays in his father's laboratory in Leningrad, that time called St. Petersburg. Gamma rays from a radioactive source knock electrons from atoms. Skobeltsin hoped to detect the tracks of such electrons in a cloud chamber. That's a chamber that's sealed and filled with a inert gas. Neon, argon. Skobeltsin hoped to detect the tracks of such electrons in a cloud chamber, but he encountered a problem. The gamma rays also knocked electrons out of the walls of the chamber, just as well as anything in the cloud chamber. The walls of the chamber also were affected. And these interfered with his measurements. To overcome this, and this was an epical decision on the part of one human being which influenced the entire direction of science. Notice the power of the individual. Notice the resonance of an individual decision on high levels of consciousness. Skobeltsin decided to place the chamber between the poles of a large magnet so that the magnetic field would deflect away the unwanted electron. He just wanted to protect the chamber walls, and so used... how are you going to keep the electrons away? Well, you need something that can do this. A magnetic field will do this. A magnetic field exerts a force on an electrically charged particle so that its path becomes curved, curves away. The curvature, the amount of curve, the curvature depends on the strength of the field and on the particle's momentum, the product of its mass and velocity. Two particles traveling at the same speed, but one heavier will have more mass. The curvature is greater for slow or lightweight particles, low momentum, than for fast or heavy ones. In this way, the magnetic field can distinguish different particles. But at this time, Skobeltsin's time, in 1923, nobody knew anything about particles, except they were trying to track mysterious things, cosmic rays. Cosmic rays had been first thought of by a mad Parisian named Wolf, who went up to the top of the Eiffel Tower and found there's more radiation at the top of the tower than on the streets of Paris. And maybe they better not build higher towers. And should one go up in a balloon even higher and see is there more radiation? But he was afraid to go up in the balloon. The top of the Eiffel Tower did it for him. And so a man named Victor Hess decided to go up 5,000 meters. 3 miles up in a balloon, and found indeed the radiation is colossal compared with the ground level. In fact, after 1,000 meters, there's a radical change, and the curve, the rise of radiation, is quite steep. Eventually, a man named Robert Millikan at Caltech, feisty Bob Millikan, name them cosmic rays. It's a radiation that comes from outer space. Is there a source? They seem to travel in straight parallel lines and be omnipresent, so if there is a source, it must be so incredibly far away that by now all of the rays just seem to be in parallel lines. None of this was known at this time. All of it was imminent. All of it was coming up. So Skobeltsin worked with this for a while. It took a while to do these things. And by 1927, 1928, he was finally in a position to work with his equipment and take it to the first step. On some of the photographs he took in 1927, 28, Skobeltsin noticed a few tracks that were almost straight. These indicated values of momentum and energy much greater than for electrons from any known source at the time. Skobeltsin supposed that the tracks were due to fast-moving electrons knocked from atoms by cosmic gamma rays. Cosmic rays are gamma rays. This was the year before Bertha and Koholster set up their cosmic ray telescope and discovered that cosmic rays are actually charged particles. Although he did not realize it then, Skobeltsin, early 1928, had become the first person to observe directly the tracks of the cosmic rays themselves. Skobeltsin did not follow up his discovery, but 2 years later, in Robert Millikan instructed one of his research students, Carl Anderson, to build a cloud chamber to study the energies of the cosmic ray particles. They weren't called cosmic rays yet in 1930. They were about to be called that. With the assistance of engineers at the nearby aeronautical laboratory, also on Caltech's campus, and these buildings are still there. You can go over, you can see the nice little concrete bust of Robert Millikan set into a little niche, looking just like he wanted to look, like a Roman god in the Pantheon. And he's there. Anderson built a powerful water-cooled electromagnet. There were hollow copper tubes wound with the magnet and just tap water running through to cool this powerful magnet, which was 10 times stronger than the one that Skobeltsin had used. Carl Anderson. His first dramatic results showed that the cosmic rays contained both positively and negatively charged particles in about equal numbers. In other words, it was a great surprise. Everyone was just getting used to the idea that electrons, as negatively charged particles, make everything happen. And lo and behold, these universal cosmic rays have equal numbers of positive and negatively charged particles. So that the first particle that man ever discovered outside of the naturally occurring atom, in other words, electrons as a particle, could be observed by attenuating oneself to nature, to the ultimate level. If you are natural, to the ultimate yogic level, the most that you can detect is an electron. In 1930, consciousness went the first little baby step into the surreal, into the supernatural. And that first particle was the positively charged complement to the electron called the positron. So the very first indication that man had entered from the standpoint of his traditional natural career on this planet, had entered into a supernatural phase, was the discovery of the positron. We're here in Pasadena, California, 1930. That's not very long ago. That's less than 60 years ago. So Carl Anderson had discovered that there's both positive and negatively charged particles and cosmic rays, equal numbers, but his professor, the little god, Robert Millikan, as professors are, said, no, this can't be it. My idea is this. So Millikan still believed that cosmic ray particles were just electrons knocked from atoms by primary gamma rays, so that this observation came as something of a surprise. He insisted that the positive particles must be protons, also knocked from atoms by the high energy gamma rays, to produce tracks of similar curvatures to the electrons. The much heavier protons would have to be moving much more slowly. However, few of the tracks had the dense ionization expected for slow particles. Anderson, on the other hand, thought that the tracks could be due to electrons moving upwards through the chamber rather than downward moving positive particles. But Millikan did not like that idea at all. and stuck to his belief that the tracks were due to protons. No, they are protons. No, they are this. No, no. To settle the debate, Anderson inserted a lead plate across the chamber, cloud chamber. Particles traversing the plate would lose energy and be more curved by the magnetic field on emerging into the chamber again. In this way, he could tell the direction of the particles and so be certain of their charges. The modification soon revealed that both Millikan and Anderson had been wrong. They were both wrong. Why were they both wrong? Because the world of common sense is based upon a natural referent correspondence, and it does not work at all in the surreal. The best that you can do in nature, to be metaphorical, is to have a jet engine. But a jet engine can't work in outer space. The same thing in consciousness, the ideas that work in nature are literally ineffective in the real. They bear no relationship whatsoever to the real. They only have their traction in a delimited appearance realm. This is exactly how Dharma always has been understood. Now is being found. It's what happens in the empirical sciences of physics. 1930 is about the beginning when this was really starting to set in on people. They'd both been wrong. Anderson found a beautiful example of a positive particle that was clearly much lighter than a proton. Its ionization and curvature suggested a mass similar to the electrons. The electron's mass is about 1/1850th of a proton, so it's considerably lighter. The positron has a mass about the same, in fact, exactly the same as the electron. So it would take 1,850 positrons to make the mass of a proton. Anderson then had discovered the positron, the anti-electron, which had already been predicted by a consciousness which was already able to think in the surreal, in the supernatural. That consciousness belonged to a man named Paul Dirac, D-I-R-A-C. And in fact, we'll get to Dirac in just about 25 minutes. The reprint here from Oxford University Press of his classic book, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics, which came out, I believe, in 1930. Yeah, first edition, 1930. Notice, Dirac's book had come out in 1930, and just exactly at that time, just a little bit after that time, the experimental data began to confirm what the vanguard of consciousness had been able to envision. Those who were there Thursday night recognized again the spiritual trigger that man holds in this cosmos. For those who were there Thursday night for the lecture on the double helix, you recall that it wasn't until Francis Crick's consciousness was able to conceive a certain quality of structure, and immediately after that, the lab work at Cambridge University in England began to show that structure. It had never been seen before, but as soon as almost a spontaneous correspondence, as soon as a consciousness could conceive of it, the empirical technology which was attuned to the threshold of that consciousness is able to disclose, oh yes, here it is, here it is, here it is. Man makes not only history, but reality. It's the old ancient Egyptian Hermetic idea again. Every time you step into the unknown, you carry the making capacity, the poesis, as the Greeks would say, of the known into the unknown. And that unknown now becomes known and has a definite manifestation quality. It's no longer the uncreated. Now it is a part of the created. And every aspect of that responds now. Every aspect can be known. So in the ancient Egyptian Hermetic theology, Ra steps forth before man to create new spaces of the known, new spaces where life can be. And as soon as man's space dies out here, he has a new space to go to, which Ra has livened. And so man, following Ra through the universe, lives life eternal. It's called living time. And the way it was symbolized in ancient Egypt was the infinity sign on its side, pronged into a dynamic direction. In 1930, a very few human beings, not more than you could count on your fingers and your toes, were penetrating through a static universe which had previously seemed like a dynamic universe. It was penetrating through a universe that had been established by Sir Isaac Newton a couple of hundred years before. And in Newton's time, it had seemed that man had finally left a static old universe behind and entered into a dynamic new universe. In the 1930s, the very eerie kind of experience was that the Newtonian universe was another form of stasis which we had now, just now, achieved the capacity to penetrate through into a truly dynamic universe. And in the 1990s now, we're penetrating through that 1930s universe and seeing that it was just as static as Newton's, just as static as ancient physics from the 400s. The same Hermetic process. The chronos, that forethought, that forerunner, creates new life spaces, and all of the energies go into that new life space and leave behind the stasis in its mummification. Dirac was the first to conceive of this particle in a mathematical way. Anderson, in experimenting under Robert Millikan, is the first to confirm it within months of each other. This was the first observation of an elementary particle that does not reside within the atom. I'm going to leave off here for a minute and go over here to Millikan. This is Millikan's book that was published by the University of Chicago Press. It came out in 1935. Its title is Electrons, Positive and Negative, Protons, Photons, Neutrons, and Cosmic Rays. You can get a sense of Millikan's imperial personality here. He left off the "and I," but you can read it in the title. I love Milliken, and he's all right, but we have to appreciate him in this way. Milliken's book in 1935, nicely bound like this, was preceded just 8 years before by a very pretentious book, also by Milliken, published, I believe, by Yale. Yes, Yale University Press, 1927, entitled Evolution in Science and Religion. And Milliken in here, second chapter, headline, New Truth and Old. You ready for the scale? Judgment. He writes, 1927, the more intimately one gets into touch with any civilization of bygone days, and the more carefully he studies the thought, the feeling, the action of men and women who lived in Pompeii, in ancient Athens, in Thebes, or in Babylon, the more he is struck by the similarity between the way people seem to have lived and talked and thought 2,000 or 3,000 years ago and the way they live and talk and think now. The jokes and the horseplay of flautists are surprisingly like the humor of Huck or Life or Punch, or one can imagine Cicero, the wisest of Romans, sitting with his friends in a patio in Pompeii and saying nearly the same things we say as we sit in patios in Pasadena. Further on. We have a changed conception of the universe. This is 1927. And man's whole conception of the universe took at least 2 centuries to accomplish this result that we now understand the new world, 1927. For this was the indispensable idea that made possible, first, the discovery of the law of gravitation, and second, the ultimate triumph of celestial mechanics, a triumph which robbed the planets of their age-long dominance over the lives of men, of their proud position as arbiters of his destiny. Notice that Milton here is saying in 1927 that Newtonian dynamics, Newtonian mechanics, invalidated in terms of conscious structure for the first time the conscious hold of astrology. Notice the cosmic dimensions that Professor Milton from Caltech in 1927 is introducing into their work in the laboratory. It's characteristic. All of them thought this way. All of them had similar thoughts, that there are religious implications to what we are doing. And personal emendations have to be made about how we conduct our expectations about life, all of it. It's just that Milton is more open in this regard than most people. It changed conceptions of duty and the second element in religion because it began to reveal a nature of orderliness and a nature capable of being known, a nature, too, whose functioning might be predicted, a nature which could be relied upon, a nature also of possibly unlimited forces capable of being discovered and then of being harnessed for the benefit of mankind. Listen with a distance, because all of this will be negated in about 3 years. When we jump to Dirac, writing in 1930, all of this that Milliken is so confident about in 1927 will be uprooted, never to be returned to again. Are we needing to change our tapes?